Blog Talk Radio.
About the remix. Speaking of which, this is Scott Percondy with the Clown Hour. I'm the creator of the Clown Time Sports Bar. That's Clown spelled with a K. And you'll be able to find me on the web. Just type in your URL window, www.theclowntimes.net, and you can find me on Facebook as well. Just do a search for the Clown Times. It's again Clown spelled with a K. You'll be able to find me. Well, I rambled through my thoughts on Duke on Duke's 2013 football season because my guest Julian King from SB Nation has technical difficulties, but he's back. I found my man, and when I mentioned the remix earlier, I do mean it in every sense of the word. This is the Duke podcast remix, so. Without further ado, Julian, what's up? Welcome back to the Clown Hour. How are you doing?
Pretty good, Scott. How are you doing?
Good, bro. Well, first of all, thank you for hanging in there and being and joining the show like a champ. I know with everything going on that trust me, from one family dude to another with a lot of stuff going on, I feel you. So it's all good.
Okay.
So first of all, before we get started, why don't you tell us all pretty much how you started running SB Nation's Duke Basketball Report and pretty much how you got that started.
Well, we started a long time ago. It started in actually 1996. We came over to SB Nation a couple of years ago, and we just joined the platform this fall. So we've been at it for a while.
Okay. So basically... Since this blog is titled Duke Basketball Report, given Duke's lack of football tradition, I assume that you probably didn't have trouble naming this blog the way you did, right?
I mean, it's, in the last 20 years, really, it's all been about basketball at Duke. But when you say there's no tradition, that's not true. There's just no recent tradition, no recent success. But, if you go back, Duke has... Duke has a tremendous football tradition. It just basically came to grinding halt in the 70s. And it's been really, hit and miss since then. I mean, they were as good as anybody for a long time. At a certain point, it just changed in football. When they double platoon football, Duke had a hard time adjusting to that.
So what do you think made things change in the 70s to lead to recent struggles until maybe Steve Spurrier, then now with Coach Cutcliffe?
Well, I think when they went to liberal substitution, a lot of state schools, were able to recruit a lot more, and Duke had higher academic standards, and it was harder to find guys like Ace Parker. I mean, that guy could play any position on the field, and they went both ways, and then when you had to come up with 80 guys who are academically qualified and athletically qualified, it was a lot harder. Duke institutionally lost interest in football for a while. They just didn't expect it to succeed. And a few years ago, they kind of realized that football really was important, and you couldn't just expect basketball to do everything. And so they really started to take football seriously again, and that's when they basically hired David Cutcliffe.
Right. So basically, I mentioned earlier, podcast that I think that either the athletics department is either pledging more resources to Duke University football, or it's already there, or they already implemented somehow. Do you know if they have any practice facilities along the way? Like, I should say coming down the pipe, or is it already there, or what's happening with Duke University football these days in terms of resources and efforts?
Well, they've made a lot more commitment to resources in the last 10 years, and there's it was pretty bare bones for a long time, and the stadium is, by modern standards, small. It's a pretty stadium, but it's small. And
right.
they've built a practice, indoor practice facility. They built a weight center. They've done a lot of things to really upgrade the facilities. They're going to do some more work on the stadium in the next 2 years, really update it a lot. I mean, it's never going to be huge, but they'll make it as modern and contemporary as possible. Biggest change though is the coach. Yeah, they're going to do a lot of facility upgrades in terms of it's going to be a lot nicer, I think. But it's still, it was built in 1930s, and
right.
It's just it's like Cameron. There's only so much you can do with Cameron because of the age of the facility, and you have to highlight the tradition rather than the slickness.
Right. So when you say modern changes to it, because I know Wallace Way Stadium is like a horseshoe. Well, it is a horseshoe.
It's a horseshoe.
Do you envision them enclosing like the horseshoe, like similar to what they did in Ohio State? When they had the bleachers put in the back, or what changes are coming down the pipe with that?
Well, I think they've talked about that, and I think as of right now, they're not going to do that. But I know it's been discussed. But a lot of what they're going to do is going to be on the upstairs, basically, if you will. It's been really bare bones. It was like for a long time, the restrooms were sort of these things that were in there from the 30s, and they were outdoor. I mean, they were separate buildings, but the plumbing was the plumbing was original. I mean, and that was getting to be really pretty too much. And then they fixed that, and they're gonna tear down the part of the facility where the press box is and rebuild that and make that a lot nicer. I'm not sure, I might be wrong here, but there'll be some guest boxes and things like that there. And just in general, I mean, it's past time to update. They put in a new scoreboard which has a beautiful screen on it. You can really see things, and that's a nice thing. I think the biggest change to the football program is just the coach.
Yeah. You're not going to get an argument with me on that. I mean, because I was saying that Coach Cutcliffe, what's so special about him, what differentiates him from most of the other coaches outside of Jimbo Fisher is that Cutcliffe is an SEC guy. He tutored Peyton Manning while he was the offensive coordinator at the University of Tennessee. He later recruited and coached Eli Manning while he was the head coach at Ole Miss. So he's bringing how they do things in the SEC and merge it to how Duke does it with their academics, and is able to put together over the past three seasons, if you will, a faster team on offense, a team with more athletes. And, they're not as deep as, say, Florida State, and they probably never will be, but the fact that they've been on the upswing the past two seasons, or three seasons, really, under Coach Cutcliffe, because I think three seasons ago he finished with 5 wins. Then last season it was a 6-win season, and now 10 wins. So the uptick is going up, and with more resources pouring into the football program, and Cutcliffe doing his thing with the Manning Passing Academy, which leads to, more recruiting, right? And it's the sky's the limit right now, I think, at least in my opinion, thanks to Coach Cutcliffe.
Well, I think there's a couple points I want to make about that. One is I think that you're right in the sense that he's brought in some things from the SEC that you didn't have before. But one thing that I would say that's different, because probably not that great, but the SEC institutionally tends to take some shortcuts to get football successful, and he has not done that. Everything's built from the ground up, and he's built very carefully and not taking shortcuts like academically or in terms of bringing in, shaky people, shaky characters.
Right.
He's been pretty careful about doing things exactly the way he wants to do them. And he, when you hear football coaches talk about, you know, the way football coaches talk, a lot of us tend to roll our eyes and think, yeah, sure, whatever, coach.
Of course.
You know, in his case, he actually means it, and he really takes those things seriously. And it's football can be an important part of a young man's maturity, and not just a chance to get out and, you know, raise Cain and play football. And he's actually turning out really good men, which is, I think, the most impressive thing about what he's done at Duke. You're right, though. He has adapted. He has brought in a lot of ideas, a lot of things from the SEC culture, and improved Duke's football culture dramatically, because there really wasn't a football culture when he came. I knew a guy that was a wide receiver that I worked with for a while, and it was just, you know, it was a really dispirited place. Nobody's really interested in the football. They were there to get it. And this sounds kind of stupid, too, but they were there just for education, which is, you know, what they should be there for. But they didn't care about the team. You know, they weren't interested in the team. It was just a means to an end. And at this point, I think he's instituted a program where people really take pride in, and they really try hard, and they try hard academically, and they give their all in everything they're doing. And that comes directly from his standards and his ideas. And a lot of it's really old-fashioned, but he believes in it, and it works.
Right. And you know,
in terms of the recruiting, and the sky's the limit. I'm not as sure about that, because their pool is much smaller.
Of course, I think he's been really
smart about how he's approaching it. But you know, you could have a bad year in recruiting, still have a really solid program, and it could filter through in a couple of years, and you have a down year or two that you wouldn't see in, say, Florida State, because they have a much broader pool of potential recruits than, you know, Duke or Vanderbilt or Notre Dame. There's not a lot of allowance given for them.
Speaking of Florida State, I know that Duke got their doors blown off of them 45-7. I mean, after all, Florida State had, you know, beat the hell out outside of Boston College, that is. Beat the hell out of all the teams in the schedule. But one thing I did like about Duke, I mean, they started out off the game fired up. You know, they came out hitting Florida State in the mouth. Early and often, and they held Florida State. I know, you know, this sounds silly, but I'm about to say it, but they held Florida State to 7 points in the first quarter, okay? Mm-hmm. But the thing is that I think Duke, like, didn't cash in on lots of opportunities early in the game. I think they dropped what would have been a touchdown pass, like one of the wide receivers did, and, you know, they failed to capitalize off of turnovers, which would have made the game a little bit more compelling. But I think that, you know, Florida State eventually wore them down the end, because, you know, Florida State is deeper. Like you pointed out, you know, they're deeper, and they just wore Duke out. But I like the way Duke fought. I like the way Duke showed up. I like the way Duke didn't curl up into the fetal position, rather, and punk out. So what was your take on Duke's and how Duke did in the championship game, and how it could help them in seasons to come?
Well, I think you got it about right. I mean, you might remember last year in the Belk Bowl, they were winning that game until the last minute, and they just sort of flukishly lost on them 2 touchdowns in the last minute of the game. And it just seemed like, you know, Duke football, and that's what a lot of us thought. Well, that's Duke. What we didn't know was that got incorporated into their approach to the season. And They were, you know, that was a really useful game for Duke in a lot of ways. And when I've contended this year, when, you know, they beat Virginia Tech at Virginia Tech, they beat, I don't know if you pay attention to the
Miami
game, but they took Miami apart. And it was late in the game. You know, Duke used to not be a fourth quarter team, and this team gets stronger as the game goes on, with the exception of Florida State. They, you know, even in the fourth quarter, they're very likely to just take you apart. They've done it consistently. It's pretty different for Duke. I mean, to do that, and a lot of it's because of that game and because of the mentality that they've developed this season. But I agree with you completely about the Florida State game. I know they were getting, after about 20 minutes, you know, the fact that Florida State just had more players and more talent basically went out. But, you know, for 20 minutes they competed nose-to-nose, and after that, even when Florida State was running away at the game, they were hitting them, man. I mean, every once in a while I look up and I'd see them just just lay into one of their players and go, man, that was a song. And I couldn't believe it because Duke hasn't been like that in my lifetime that I can remember.
Right, same here.
That's a nasty tackle, man. And they really did. They competed the entire game, even though they got beat. They never stopped. They kept playing. And I know some of those guys woke up the next day and knew they'd been in a football game.
Yes, and you know what? Speaking of big hits, one that stood out to me in particular was when that kid, I forget his name, the defensive back, nailed Nick O'Leary in the end zone. Just nailed his ass.
That's what I was thinking about. Yeah, that's,
I mean,
the one,
just
that's
tattooed
what I just kind of, ooh. Yeah, that was a huge hit.
I mean, the thing was,
see that.
Right. I mean, we never saw that at a Duke team. I've never seen it ever in my life. You know, that fight. They fought.
Well, I tell you, the guy, Cutcliffe, has really changed this program. There wasn't really a program to speak of.
Right.
I mean, people showed up and they played for 4 years. But when he got here, the first thing he said was, I've never seen a more out-of-shape football team in my life. And basically, he didn't just get him in the locker room, in the weight room. He was doing stuff with them that I think really caught them off guard and caught the rest of us off guard because, for instance, at one point, he took them around campus and picked up trash. And he said, it's your campus, and this is where you live, and you should take care of it. And he had that. It wasn't like he sent the managers out or the redshirt freshman. He took the whole team out and picked up trash all over campus. I mean, his approach is really different from what we've seen before here. And he's done a lot to build pride and camaraderie. And, I don't know if you saw it today or not. I'm a kid. I should tell you guys' name in a minute. I can't think of it right now. But one of the backs was kicked off the team for a year. Jalen Duncan, and he won't play next year. I don't want to speculate on why, but for various reasons, was kicked off the team and he's gone for a year. He can't play next year. He's done that before. There's other guys who've been in trouble. He's like, look, we got standards. You violated the standard. I don't want you on the team right now. Come back in a year when you're ready. And, there's none of this stuff you see. I don't want to pick on anybody in particular, but at Florida State with what's the quarterback, James Winston?
James Winston.
Somebody sent me a story, a member of the faculty sent me a story, where he was accused of more than just the sexual assault. There's a fair amount of things, like shooting windows out of a building. Somebody accused him of that, the police were called, and other not good behavior, and there are places where you can go where that sort of thing, football players do that, and it's just sort of, glossed over. And Kentucky does it in basketball, and it's glossed over. And, Cook was not going to gloss anything over. I mean, if you don't do what you're supposed to do, you're gone, man. I mean, he's not having it. And I think that's great. I really do. I think it builds more in your program to, it's going to hurt Duke in the bowl game, but because he won't be playing in the bowl game. Or next year, but in terms of overall discipline and structure of the program, I think it's great. I think it's a tremendous thing to do. I'm happy that happened, but I'm happy that they're not ducking it.
Right, exactly, and that's the thing. I do remember seeing like clips of Coach Cutcliffe in his first few seasons where he challenged a player who was tired. He's like, I'm just paraphrasing. He's like, If you want to rest, you can't rest here. Just looking dead in his eye and told him that it was kind of, because to your point earlier, like he said, that was the most out of shape team he's seen. So he would have been there behind in the shape, and that's, and like I said, I mean, that those elements, the SEC way of life, if you will, aside from the scandals, just basically getting those boys to play and other opponents down and pose their will on the other opponents, like they did in Blacksburg when they won a defensive battle. Like they did in Charlottesville when they came from 22 points down, they scored the final 35 points of the game. Against Miami when Miami got off to that quick lead and all of a sudden they being the Blue Devils just pulled away from them in the fourth quarter and beat them down. Beat Miami down. I mean, we just hadn't seen that, And that's just amazing. I mean, Coach Cutcliffe is the man, and, you know, I'm pretty sure that, you know, the AD's pretty much giving him as many resources that, you know, as he wants at this point, you know, because he sees the results, you know?
Yeah. Well, the thing, you know, like I say, the thing about the guy that he's a man of his word, and, you know, a lot of people say that about coaches, but he's a little bit different. I mean, you know, he tells you exactly what he thinks. He never sugarcoats it, and he sticks to what he says. I mean, if he said he's going to do it this way, he's going to do it this way. And if he says, you don't do it my way, you're not going to be on the team, that's that. He'll sit a really important player and not think twice about it because he wants, you know, message to get through everybody else. That there's not going to be any cutting any corners. So that's really the key to what's happened. I mean, in terms of good football turnaround, it's just basically they built it. I mean, and they built it from the ground up. I mean, there's nothing there when he started. I think they challenged the offensive line to lose 1,000 pounds or something like that. I can't remember who he challenged. It was a particular group of players. He said, you guys are going to lose like 1,000 pounds by the time the season comes around. And, and they did it. It wasn't 8 players. It was more than that. But, you know, it was a group of guys. And he said, you guys are going to lose this much weight by October, you know, by September. And they did it. It's been a fun season. I mean, it's something obviously we're not used to is having a football team be at all dominant. I mean, you know, when Spurrier was here, that was a lot of fun because, I mean, you know, Spurrier is like, nobody knew at that point how good he was. But, you know, just having a team that came out and ran past people and blew people's doors off was fun. But, you know, that's just Spurrier's offensive genius. I mean, it's just what he does. And as soon as he was gone, the program went back to where it was. I have a feeling Cutcliffe's in a position where he could build something that somebody else could maintain, and that hasn't happened in Duke since the 50s.
Wow. Yeah, do you ever see, and I'm just throwing this as a side when you mentioned Spurrier, do you ever see, like, Coach Cutcliffe, like, taking a picture underneath the scoreboard when it, like when they beat down UNC in the future, like Spurrier did in that one season.
No, I don't think he's going to do that.
Oh, my, that was hilarious. That's I love Coach Spurrier. I love him.
The thing about Spurrier, he has two things that he does that are genius. One is offense, and the other is making people mad. And he had the people at Florida State and Tennessee and Georgia, and when he was in the ACC, Virginia and Carolina, ready to kill him. I mean, just ready to kill him. Virginia still hates Duke, and they don't even remember why.
It's because Are you serious?
Spurrier drove them crazy. Yeah, oh, yeah. They were, a couple of years ago, they came to the game, and the guy said, one of their kids said, I hate Duke. I don't know why. I just hate Duke. And I know why. It's because Spurrier got under their skin so bad that they stayed mad for 20 years.
That's hilarious.
I mean, he has a genius for irritating people, and it's a marketing genius too. Because you look at what Florida and Tennessee football is like when he was there. I mean, that was unbelievable.
Oh yeah,
he did the same thing with Carolina and Virginia, just on a smaller scale, where they were like ready to rip our heads off. I think
right.
It was like, like 15 years before we beat Carolina again after he left.
That's right, it did.
It took a long time.
So basically, now we cross forward to the present. Well, kind of the future-ish, if you will. Duke is in the Peach Bowl. I call it the Peach Bowl still, but it's a Chick-fil-A Bowl against Texas A&M. So first of all, do you think? First of all, do you think the Peach Bowl got it right with the selection of Duke? And secondly, what did he make of Duke's chances against A&M and Johnny Manziel?
Well, to go to the first question, I think from what they said afterwards, they said they wanted Duke, you know, all along. And when you look at it, I mean, I think you're pretty insightful because you realize that this is a different sort of Duke team. They translate well to TV, which is nice for any ball game. I can't think of any reason or anything Duke has to offer or to request that would get them favors in football. I mean, I could see it in basketball. But I can't see it in football because they're just new kids on the block, and who cares? You know, so I'm pretty sure that the Peach Bowl took them because they wanted them. And I don't know who would politic on their behalf. You know, I don't think the ACC would necessarily. I mean, not that the ACC is down on Duke football, but, I mean, there's no incentive to bargain for Duke. Duke hasn't proven anything in terms of ratings or, you know, drawing TV crowds. So there's no particular reason for Duke to have any kind of an in with any bowl game. I think they made the choice they wanted. As far as Texas A&M goes, I get the sense just by looking at the comments and reading the newspapers and whatnot that at least the fans aren't taking this very seriously. And you know that if a team starts to pick up that attitude, that they're already in trouble.
Right.
If you think you don't have to worry about your opponent and your opponent hits you in the mouth, then you've got a serious problem because you're not expecting it. Based on the beginning of the Florida State game, based on Virginia Tech and Miami, those are pretty, you know, those are pretty solid football teams, and Duke took it to all of them. I wouldn't necessarily say I favor Duke in this game, but I would say that, you know, Duke's got a chance, and that it's going to be magnified if that attitude continues. I mean, you can't, you know, you have to be kind of crazy to dismiss. Even though it's from a lesser league, which the ACC is compared to the SEC, winning 10 games and winning the way that Duke won them is not a fluke or an accident. I mean, they won those games. And
right.
they won a lot of them against teams that they haven't beaten in years. What's working against them right now is that their second quarterback, I don't know if you paid enough attention to see it, but Anthony Boone's the starting quarterback. Brandon Connett plays about as much. And he's a pretty good running quarterback, and they just sort of rotate around. Sometimes they put them both in at the same time, you know, and they'll have two quarterbacks in the backfield. And Connett's a good runner and, you know, a good passer, and Boone's an excellent passer and a good runner. So, I mean, you don't know where it's coming at you at that point. Connett's mother got very sick. She has a brain tumor. So he's gone home, and he may or may not be in the game. We don't know if he's going to play or not. He's not practicing right now. So, I mean, you know, that's going to be an advantage for Texas A&M. And losing the running back is obviously not going to help. Although Duke has rotated three guys, so, you know, for one game they can probably get by with two. But that's two good skill players that may be there or may not be there. I don't think it's clear yet about Connett. And obviously, you know, his mom had emergency brain surgery. I mean, you want to be with your mom at that point. And football is pretty secondary. So, we'll
right,
see. But I think in general, you know, they're healthy, they're tough. And the thing that a lot of people don't realize is how young this team is. There are only a few seniors, and most of the team is back next year. And they've got an excellent class coming behind it. So it's going to be, you know, it's not going to be like a one-year thing. And they could win 8 games next year and be a better team, you know, just because they're more experienced and stronger. And not win as many games and be better. They're not going. I don't think they're going away anytime soon.
So basically, to your point, do you expect, like, basically, you know, a lot of people expect Miami to be a lot better. Many people expecting Virginia Tech to be better. Many people expecting UNC, now they got Marquise Williams doing his thing this year as a freshman, to be a lot better next year. You know, because he's the ideal quarterback under Larry Fedora's system. How do you see Duke fitting in that hierarchy, if you will? How do you see them, like, finishing next season already, if you wanted to get a quick pronunciation of it?
Well, I don't know yet. I mean, I really haven't looked that carefully at next year, but outside of Duke. Obviously, Carolina's going to have some structural problems for a while because of the probation and the fact that they've gotten behind on recruiting and stuff like that. So it may take them a year or two to really get their program back where they wanted. But I thought they did a tremendous job this year to come back from where they started and to finish as well as they did. But, you know, they're gonna be missing some things for a little while, put it that way.
Right.
I'm sure Miami's rebuilding, and they were pretty good anyway. I mean, they've got Andy Cal Golden is just getting this program started, and he seems like a really good coach. So I would think, you know, in a year or two, when he's had a chance to really get his guys in and get everybody really thoroughly familiar with his system, that they're going to be tough. Mm-hmm. He seems like a really, really sharp guy in a lot of ways. In general, I think the ACC is improving and will continue to improve. I think everybody's pretty much gotten to the point where Duke has really realized football is you can't just do basketball as much as we love basketball here. Right now, you have to compete in football to compete in general. And you're going through what we went through in the last few years with expansion and then another round of expansion. And, everybody's trying to improve football. And I think that, it's going to be more competitive as you go forward. I mean, Wake Forest just hired a guy. I don't know much about him, but from what I learned about
Bowling Green.
He seems like a really smart young coach, and he wants to be at Wake Forest. And, you can build something successful if you have people who buy in and who like the way you do things. You can do it even though Wake Forest is a tiny school. They can have a pretty good football team. So I think everybody's in position to improve.
Right. And that's a good thing for ACC success, because with Florida State being in the national championship game again,
mm-hmm.
For the first time in like over 14 years. But basically, people now could see, now just, to your point, ACC football can be a player in the national scene again. I mean, once the U starts becoming the U again, which I think will happen sooner rather than later, especially after mm-hmm. this season that they won 9 games underneath that cloud of NCAA suspicion, and Duke being like on the huge upswing that it is, and of course there's Florida State, Clemson, and Atlanta, as well as Louisville coming in next year, without Teddy Bridgewater, I think the ACC fall is going to make some, people thought it made a little bit of noise this year. They're going to make a hell of a lot of sounds next year and years beyond, given that all these teams, all these programs are on the uptick.
Well, obviously the SEC is really dominant, and the football culture there is different than
right.
anywhere else. And the Big Ten has a really solid football culture and a lot of money because of the Big Ten network. But
mm-hmm.
the thing that the ACC has that nobody else has is the population base. And
right.
that translates ultimately into media because, ratings will come through it will come through for basketball immediately and for football as things improve. But over the years, a lot of schools have picked North Carolina clean and, the non-ACC schools. The better players
right.
have gone elsewhere. And that's true for, probably Virginia, too, although Virginia Tech has done a pretty good job of retaining
mm-hmm.
local players. But one of the things that Cutcliffe has done, for instance, is he's got more players now from North Carolina than NC State or Carolina does. We've got a higher
mm-hmm.
concentration of in-state players than anybody else. But I think over the next 5 to 10 years, I think you'll see that the having the population based on the Eastern Seaboard is really going to help ACC football.
I'm going a little off tangent, but do you see the ACC network pick up within the next few years, and do you think it will be a success because I think it will be a success because what you said, the population base alone would actually carry it.
Talk
about Pittsburgh, New York.
Yeah. I think there's a basis for saying that, but I think there's an interesting conundrum with that, and a lot of people are it's not going to work for everybody, first of all.
Sure.
And secondly, we're hitting a point pretty soon where the cost of acquiring TV is getting to the point where people are just going to give up on it because it costs too much to have. If you break down a cable bill, the by far the biggest part of it is ESPN. I mean, that's where they're really making you pay a lot of money. And that's not going to stop. I mean, it's going to keep accelerating. And at some point, it has to change. And my argument has been that I don't think that you should necessarily, you might want to pursue it, but then pursue everything simultaneously. But I don't think that that's necessarily the long-term answer to, it's going to be for the next 10 years, next maybe 15, 20 years. But it's already, there's if you look at the stats, you can see charts floating around showing the rate of decline of people who are giving it up. and you could almost correlate it to the increases in sports fees. And mm-hmm. so, what do you do? I mean, if you live in an area where you have the SEC or the Big Ten or the ACC, and then they add in, you know, whatever other sports networks, that, you know, I mean, whether it's Fox Sports or NBC Sports or whoever it is, all those guys are going to continue to raise their fees, and it's unsustainable in the long run. My thing is, I would love to see the ACC be really aggressive about moving into, even though it's still really early, moving into internet broadcasting.
Right.
And if you look at, for instance, Apple TV, as it stands today, you know, you have apps on the screen, and if one of the apps says Duke versus, you know, Texas A&M, and then you can click on that, and you can buy that for whatever, $2 or whatever the because, you know, $2 for a game, when you compare it to, like, you know, your team, whoever your team is, that's like a reasonable amount of money. If it's $5 a game, that's a reasonable amount of money for the season for one team as opposed to everything. And that might be, in the long term, a better solution for a lot of people. But I just think it's unsustainable the way the TV market is now. You just can't expect it to continue to work. I mean, the basic theory is, you know, keep acquiring rights and raising fees. Well, you know, I mean, that just can't last indefinitely. There's just no way. Eventually, it has to collapse.
Right. So do you think because this is pretty fascinating. So do you think the ceiling will eventually cave in on the conference networks that's going on and the cable, like the cable, the grip that cable holds, i.e. ESPN and others, have hold on college sports? Do you think that's going to eventually collapse?
Well, I think there's going to have to be an adjustment. I think the people are still going to want to watch college sports, but they may do something like, you know, I mean, if you can't afford to drive to the Final Four, then you charter a bus, right? And you go with everybody else on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you might just start watching games on the weekend at the bar
and not having
the package at home. You go to the bar and have a couple of drinks with your friends and watch a game and then go home. It's just like the bus. But there are already people in the current situation, a lot of people are having a tough time, and it's a luxury, you know? I mean, you can't afford to pay, you know, a ton of money for TV. And
right.
I'd be real curious to see what Apple does, because I think they've got some different ideas about it. And I don't know how what their current plans are, but if they come up with a really different approach and they're able to break it up somehow.
Right.
You know, paying for an individual game for your own team is not that burdensome, but paying for, you know, Oregon versus Stanford, if you're on the East Coast, if you're on the West Coast, paying for Virginia versus BC, you know, people don't care, and they're just not going to care about that. And, you know, it's outside their interest, it's unfamiliar, and why would you pay for something like that when you just don't care? At some point, it has to be restructured, and I don't know when that is, but the current model is already falling apart. I mean, there's a dispute between, I forget now, Comcast and CBS maybe, or Time Warner and CBS.
Oh, wow.
And
really?
the network lost, during that dispute, lost 300,000 subscribers. I mean, just like that. There are a lot of people who are ready to dump it now. You know, they're keeping it, you know, like for, in my case, for instance, because, I mean, I really, you know, I'd like to watch basketball on ESPN. But if I could get it another way, I wouldn't mind dumping it. You know, if ESPN did it through their website where they could let you, you know, go into their website and pick a package or whatever, that'd be fine with me. I don't necessarily need to get it over TV. As long as I get it, I don't care how I get it. But there's a lot of changes that are going to happen to college sports on television or on broadcast, however you want to put it, that are going to, you know, I mean, you can see the big schools are trying to consolidate their position, but if people just turn it off, if they can't afford it, then it doesn't make any difference anymore. You can't sell it, people won't buy it.
Right.
I mean, if you price yourself out of the market, it's over. You know, there's nothing you can do. except lower your prices.
Yeah, we'll see that happen anytime soon. So anyway, but thanks a lot, Julian. I appreciate you hanging in there and joining and rejoining the podcast. I'm sure that we'll be talking Duke basketball within the next couple of months or so, at least before the ACC basketball tournament. So,
okay.
So I'm looking forward to that as well.
All right. Well, thanks. It's been fun.
All right. Yeah. And I agree. And thanks a lot, my man. And again, thank you for hanging in there. I appreciate it. You have a good night. You too. All right. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye. All right. You too. So there goes Julian King from SB Nation. Check him out on the Duke Basketball Report. I'm happy that he hung in there. I'm happy that because I really enjoyed that conversation. So at any rate, now we can go on the better note. So until next time, well, first of all, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, all that good stuff. And until the new year, this is Scott Brooks signing off. 06, peace out.